Dads on the air, we're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood and masculinity. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our guest today is Linda Gottlieb Case, who is a social worker and expert witness and author, and she speaks to us today from Long Island, New York, in the USA. Linda has been an expert witness in family therapy, family dynamics, parental alienation. She's well respected as an author. She presents at a number of workshops on the subjects of mental health for professionals, judges, lawyers, and alienated parents. So, Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
So, Linda, you've recently produced your book, The Parental Alienation Syndrome, A Family Therapy and Collaborative Systems Approach to Amelioration. And in that book, you discuss cases of 32 alienated parents and 56 alienated kids. It's still a controversial topic in this country. Parental alienation is something that definitely exists and something we have to be concerned about, isn't it?
Absolutely, is very commonly accepted among those clinicians who are aware of the family dynamic. To say that there's still a lot of controversy is a misnomer. It's almost like saying there's still a lot of controversy over climate change. That's absolutely not true. There's a very, very small but vocal group of people, minorities, who will say that it doesn't exist. It absolutely does. It's an observable family dynamic. I believe it's now documented in the DSM-5 under parent-child relationship problem, and a rose by any other name is still a rose. If you read pages 715 through 719, you will see this very detrimental family dynamic very well and thoroughly discussed there, and it is now called psychological abuse of a child. So it absolutely does exist, and it's absolutely documented.
So that is a big step, that it's now recognized as child abuse. And just for the sake of our listeners, you define in your book at one stage a very brief but clear definition of parental alienation as being one parent obstructing a child's relationship with the other parent, which frequently severs the relationship. Is that a fair summation of what alienation is?
Well, it's half of the definition. The other half is that the parent has done nothing to warrant the rejection, that their behavior is basically a very good and competent parent. And then the additional piece is that the child does make their own additional contributions to the rejection of the alienated parent. There are a small number of children who do resist the alienating efforts of the alienating parent, and then it's not alienation, but certainly the parent who is targeted has to go through terrible situations where they're falsely accused of child abuse and domestic violence, and so it's a terrible situation either way. But you do need the three pieces. You need the fact that a parent is being rejected and deprecated. There's an alienating, usually it's a parent, but I've seen it with older siblings. I've seen it with aunts. I have a case right now with an aunt. Sometimes I've seen foster parents. So there's an alienating authority figure. The child buys into it, and the targeted parent has done nothing to warrant the rejection by the child.
Linda, you are often appointed by the court. What does the court need to see before they call you in as either as an expert witness or for your advice?
Well, I'm usually appointed by the court to do some kind of reparative therapy because that's what I'm really all about. So there have been situations where I have been appointed by the court to assess for parental alienation. And most often, though, I am hired by the alienated or targeted parent to document the case for alienation when the forensic evaluator who had been appointed misses the alienation. And I want to stress that in these cases, probably more than 90% of evaluators miss the alienation, and that's for several reasons. Number one, the cases are very counterintuitive. For example, if a child has rejected a parent, we think that, oh, that parent must have done something awful to warrant the rejection. We don't consider the alternative explanation of a brainwashing, something like what happened in the Stockholm Syndrome or in cults. The other problem is, and most to my chagrin and my colleagues, most mental health professionals, number one, are not trained in family dynamics. They're trained in psychology or some other form of mental health counseling. A family therapist may make up 10% of the entire mental health community. It will surprise you that Family Dynamics 101 is not even a basic course, not one course, in the degree for psychology or even child psychiatry. So that's the first problem. People who are not trained in family dynamics are doing the evaluation, and then they're not trained in the subspecialty of alienation. And that's why I wrote an article for National Parents Organization called Missing the Alienation. And it's on my website. I hope everybody reads it, because that's the problem. You have to be very careful who you hire to do the forensic evaluation and also therapy. You really need to know what the expertise in family therapy is first, and then in the subspecialty of alienation.
Yes, unfortunately, I'm not surprised, because in Australia, we are way behind the recognition that you see in the United States. So anything you say about the difficulty of getting it before the judges in America is tripled in Australia.
That's really sad, because, believe me, it's not great here.
It's great to have people like you that are promoting it. But you mentioned your website then, Linda. Could you perhaps just tell our listeners where they can go to find your website?
Yes, www.nparentalalienation.com. That's END. Everything on my website can be downloaded for free. I've written 5 amicus briefs on the website, all related to parental alienation, that it's child abuse and should be viewed as such, that interviewing children is in custody and visitation is detrimental. I've talked about the misdiagnosis of mental health disorders, and also effective family therapy and support for 50-50 physical custody. Those amicus briefs are a pro bono service. I ask only that people fill in their own identifying information, and they can email me a U.S. priority mail postage label, or they can send it in the mail, and I will get it notarized and send it back to people. Wealth of information on there about research, all the articles I've written. So everything can be downloaded for free.
Well, that's a wonderful service that's available to everyone there. The website again is endparentalalienation, that's one word, .com. And now, Linda...
That's correct.
You talk about in your book about parental alienation being opportunistic, and that perhaps might explain why there in Australia there seem to be more mothers doing the alienating than fathers. Would you say that if the situation reversed, perhaps that fathers had more custody, that fathers might be more represented as alienators than those being alienated against?
Well, right. And initially, Richard Gardner and those who first started following him, we thought that only mothers did this. And now we know, and even Gardner, before he died in 2003, had said that we now know that in aggregate numbers, mothers engage in alienation more frequently, because access to the child is the environment that allows the alienation to be fostered. And in general, mothers do have physical custody of the child in greater numbers. But when fathers have custody, we now know that they will engage in alienation in equal percentages to mothers. So it is, unfortunately, an equal opportunity employer in terms of percentage-wise, not in aggregate numbers. 8 out of the 32 alienated parents whom I wrote about in my book were mothers. So that's how that happened. When fathers engage in alienation, what enables them, even if they don't have custody, is because in general, because of the disparity in income, and fathers have, generally males have more income than females, they use their increased assets to buy the loyalty of the child. That's how fathers generally do it when they do it.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. We're speaking with Linda Gottlieb Case, a social worker, expert witness in Long Island, New York. So this is Neil Diamond singing Husbands and Wives.
Two broken hearts, lonely looking like houses where nobody lives. Two people each having so much pride inside, neither side forgive. The angry words spoken in haste, such a waste of two lives. It's my belief pride is the chief cause in the decline in the number of husbands and wives. Woman and a man and a woman, some can and some can't and some can't. Lonely looking like houses where nobody lives. Two people each having so much pride inside, neither side forgive. Such a waste of two lives. It's my belief pride is the chief cause in the decline in the number of husbands and wives. A woman and a man and a woman, some can. Some can't, some can't.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And that was Neil Diamond singing Husbands and Wives. And today we're speaking with Linda Gottlieb Case in Long Island, USA. Linda, we were just speaking about the incidence of parental alienation. Do all separations lead to at least mild parental alienation?
Well, unfortunately, it's very sad, but it probably occurs in about 80% of all cases to some degree. And those were the statistics found in the book Children Held Hostage by Clower and Rivlin, and it was published by the American Bar Association. They followed, I think, 700 children for 12 years, and they found that alienation does exist to some degree in 80% of all cases. Alienation is a progressive syndrome, just like alcoholism. There's mild, moderate, and severe. So that's what Clower and Rivlin were considering. But that also speaks to the fact that we must apply the standard of time is of the essence to these cases, because if the alienation is addressed in the mild stages, it usually ends. It's only when the court system and even the mental health professionals who don't get it enable the alienating parent, and they're co-opted by the alienating parent, and it progresses, that empowers the alienating parent. And that's very, very sad. My profession is no better than the judicial system. We have to stop treating children as if they were conceived of the Immaculate Conception. And that's what they do. 80% of the case, family therapists don't, which, by the way, that's what I also am. And I practice as a family therapist more than I do as a clinical social worker. We are trained to know there's another parent out there. And we will not begin therapy or treatment without reaching out to that parent and getting the other side of the story. We all know there are two sides of every story. No one would vote for one side of the debate without hearing the alternative side. And that's what happens with most mental health professionals. They only deal with the parent who presents with the child. It's to me, that's malpractice.
Well, Linda, you say in your book that the parental alienation is actually, well, I presume this means severe alienation, but is irreversible without therapeutic and judicial intervention. Is it that serious?
In severe cases, I can tell you this. The severe alienator most likely, and the research by my colleague Amy Baker has found this, that they possess one or more of the cluster B personality disorders. That's borderline, narcissistic, and sociopathology. Character disorders are not amenable to treatment. So the alienator, and we're talking about the severe alienator. Severe alienators, as Amy Baker says, obsessed alienators, do not self-reform. So without intervention, nothing's going to change with the severe alienator. Sometimes children will eventually see the light. I still have some of the children in my book, half of whom did not reconnect with their alienated parents, are contacting me, and they've reconnected. But the child has initiated it. They somehow, for whatever reason, have seen the light. But you do bring up a very important point that I want to stress. Therapy, typical reunification therapy in severe cases, is designed to fail. The emphasis is on the alienated parent and child, and the alienating parent is left off the hook. This is like giving antibiotics to a person with an infection and returning them to the germ-infested environment that had caused the infection. The alienating home is the germ-infested environment. You have to deal with that. So what I recommend, and my colleagues recommend, in severe cases, the only effective form of therapy is transfer of custody to the alienated parent, and usually a minimum of 90 days, no contact with the alienating parent. That parent must be disempowered. When that parent is disempowered, you would be surprised how fast these kids flip like a light switch. I've worked with children who haven't seen an alienated parent in 4 years. And when the judge structured the treatment so that the alienating parent has no contact with them, in 4 sessions, those children reconnected with their alienated parent. That's how fast it can be. And that's why it's such a travesty that it's not done. It's such a simple solution, and it's not done.
You mentioned the children then and seeing the light. I like the description in your book where you say going into the world of parental alienated children is like traveling to the twilight zone. That things like some of the 8 symptoms, the independent thinker syndrome, that must make it very difficult, though, for any treatment, does it, to get the child to accept the therapist's advice?
Well, that's the whole point of a family therapist. I don't consider myself the healer of the child. The alienated parent is the healer of the child, and I'm the catalyst. That's why when I do my therapy, the alienated parent is the one really serving as the therapist. First of all, they're the only one that has a knowledge of the entire family history. These children are going to throw the therapist curveballs, and you'd have to become a PhD historian on the family to know how to respond. So I always involve the alienated parent. They're the ones that can walk down memory lane. And by the way, as part of my therapy, some of the things that I ask them to do is bring in videos and pictures of the times when they were involved with the child, or letters that they've written to each other, and loving cards, and walks them down memory lane. I mean, so many of these kids, they just start bawling and crying that they get reconnected in the therapy. But again, it's the alienated parent that does it, because no therapist, however competent and well-intentioned, can recreate the emotional connection with the child that that child has had with their parent. And that's what we rely on as family therapists. You can't talk a child out of their feelings, but put them in the room with their alienated parent, and their emotions are going to emerge.
What do you see as the motivations for the alienating parent? Why do they alienate their children from the other parent?
Well, again, because of their character disorder, they are very selfish, self-centered. They can't exist without their children. They can't share their children. These people have deep characterological flaws. We're talking about in the severe cases. And they are just unable to subvert their anger for their former partner to the love for their children. And that is why there's a very poor prognosis for a severe alienator. And that's why I say that, unfortunately, their contact with their child has to be minimized. Look, if a parent said to a child, you have to cut off one of your arms, you can't keep both of them, you have to cut off one of your arms, we would remove the child from that parent in a nanosecond and wouldn't return the child until the parent understood what they were requesting. Well, in parental alienation, they're saying you have to cut a parent out of your life. There's no difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I regret these cases. I was trained by Salvador Mnuchin. He's a world-renowned child psychiatrist. He was a founder of the family therapy movement. He was committed to the importance of both parents to a child. I still am. I will do everything I can to gain the cooperation of the alienating parent. In the end, if they're committing child abuse, then I have to accept that the remedy is what you would do with any other case of child abuse. You would remove the child from the incorrigible and abusing parent.
It's such a fascinating topic, but Linda, we've run out of time, so we might just have a short musical break and then we'll come back for a final chat. So this is Fleetwood Mac playing Oh Daddy.
If there's been a fool around, and I can't walk away from you, baby, if I try.
And that was Oh Daddy by Fleetwood Mac. So our guest today has been Linda Gottlieb Case. Linda, thank you so much for putting it in such simple terms what we should be looking out for. And I think you stress the need for all the professionals to get together, the mental health, the law enforcement, child protection, the judiciary. Everyone has to move swiftly on this to reverse this this plague of parental alienation in our society.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak to your audience.
So that's our show for this week for Dads on the Air. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners, so go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you would like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and don't forget the website of Linda Gottlieb Case, which is endparentalalienation.com. So once again, a special thank you to Linda Gottlieb Case, and we'll see you all again next week.